Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the massive release of radioactive fallout spewing from the out-of-control nuclear plants in Japan with Victor Galinsky, who served two terms as commissioner for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and was in charge of the response to the Three Mile Island accident that was almost a nuclear disaster. Then we'll get an update on the military reversals in Libya for the freedom fighters who are being routed by Gaddafi's overwhelming military power while the UN dithers over a no-fly zone. Ambassador David Mack, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, joins us to explain our inaction and the next stage in the conflict. Then finally, we'll talk about the price of oil, which has little to do with problems in Libya and Bahrain, but a lot to do with market speculation, where $40 billion is being betted by speculators that the price of oil will go up. Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, joins us. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Dr. Victor Galinsky, who is an independent consultant on energy matters. He has been deeply involved in nuclear power, nuclear proliferation, and nuclear fuel cycle and waste issues. He served for two terms as commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where he played an important role in tightening U.S. nuclear export standards, and most recently has been a consultant to the state of Nevada in relation to the proposed Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Depository. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Dr. Victor Galinsky.
Hi.
What we know, as much as we know about the ongoing disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan, where four of the six reactors are in, some of them are in what appears to be stages of meltdown, but it looks as if reactor number four that had been shut down for maintenance and the fuel rods had been removed, it looks as though the fuel rods in what is called the swimming pool are now going through criticality, and that seems like a hideous prospect.
It's not criticality, it's overheating. They've lost the water there. And the spent fuel pool has all the used fuel from previous operations. So it has many years' worth of spent fuel, and it has, or one way to look at it, is many reactor cores in there. It also has the most, as you pointed out, the most recent core, which is the hottest of all the fuel in any of the spent fuel pools. And it is so hot that if it is not underwater, if it's just in air, it will, first of all, the tubing around it will interact with hot steam to form hydrogen. The tubing will disintegrate, and the fuel itself will melt. And the danger in that is that the melted fuel will vaporize and release radioactive, the dangerous radioactive elements that were formed during the reactor operation process during fission. And there's a direct path to the air. I mean, the building is open. First of all, the building is not very strong anyway, but in any case, a whole wall is just blown open. So there's a direct path from there to the human environment.
And there have already been two fires.
Yeah, they had a fire, and then they thought they put it out, and maybe they did, but anyway, then there was another fire.
So what do you make of these stories, Victor Galinsky, about for example, in reactor two, the core getting exposed because a engine-powered pump ran out of fuel? Would that suggest, obviously on the surface it looks like incompetence, but the explanation may well be that it's very difficult to get manpower in there exposing themselves to the kind of radiation that's there on site?
Well, I don't know that I'd call it incompetence. I mean, basically what happened is you had a situation which went way beyond anything that had been foreseen in approving the safety of the plant, approving the license. And they lost electric power to all the reactors in that group, those three anyway, one, two, three. And you have to have electric power to power the emergency cooling pumps, because when a reactor shuts down, it continues to generate heat at something like initially 6 or 7% of the original, which is still huge. And if you don't get the heat out of there, ultimately the fuel is, in the first instance, damaged. As I said earlier about the spent fuel pool, the tubing reacts with steam to form hydrogen. The hydrogen can burn or explode, but then ultimately the fuel can melt, and again you've got this, you know, the fuel becomes more accessible to certainly if you have a path from there to the environment. If the fuel melts completely or the melt goes a long way, the melted fuel could melt right through the steel pressure vessel and fall into the surrounding concrete containment. It's not designed to hold anything like this. It's unclear what happens. So it's extremely grave. I would judge that process has gone at least partway in each of the first three reactors. I think they report that they think around, you know, they have it about half full of water instead of being full with water up to the required level. But I think the fuel above that has probably been destroyed, in effect, and has slumped down. But I don't think we're going to find out. I mean, assuming it doesn't get any worse, and assuming it doesn't actually proceed to the point where the stuff actually gets through the pressure vessel, and there's some hope to think that it won't, I don't think we're going to find out the status of that fuel, what actually happened in those pressure vessels, until years from now when they cool down and we cool down in terms of radioactivity and we open them up, or the Japanese open them up.
That's pretty much what happened after Three Mile Island. I think you were the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Well, I wasn't the head, but I was actually the person in charge on the first day because the chairman was away. But that's right. We didn't find out for years that half the fuel had melted. In other words, even after all the excitement, the assumption was that a very small amount of melting had taken place, if any at all. And it was a shock to discover years later that more than half the fuel had melted. And the reports that were written on the accident a year or year and a half later very much underestimated the extent of the damage. In fact, the report of the Presidential Commission, report of the NRC itself. So there are a lot of unknowns here.
Well, but are you, I mean, a lot of critics have charged that the dangers of nuclear power have been downplayed from day one. I mean, is this a pattern here?
Well, I think nuclear power is treated differently than other things in the sense that it's what's called federal preemption of all safety regulation. So whereas other things are decided by people, whether, you know, a facility goes in, or, I mean, by people in the sense of locality or the state government, in the case of nuclear power, it's pretty much decided by five commissioners in Washington. And the tendency in the Washington system and in the industry was, let me say, they didn't always have their priorities right about promoting nuclear power versus public safety. I mean, you know, everyone repeats this sort of mantra that, you know, all forms of energy have their risks, which is true. But I think it's very important that the risks be explained clearly and people have a chance to decide whether they want to take the risk or they don't want to take the risk. And that hasn't always been the case in connection with nuclear energy.
Well, we have the recent case of the Yankee plant up in Vermont that the legislature wanted to close, the governor wants to close,
right,
and yet it got relicensed. Now, of course, it got relicensed only a few days before this disaster in Japan, but what do you think explains the ability of the NRC to trump local concerns?
Well, the NRC doesn't pay that much attention to them. Incidentally, that plant is very similar to the units that we're discussing here in Japan. It's the same design. But I don't know to what extent it's been upgraded. Incidentally, there's a point here on that. It's the oldest plants of these 10 that they have in Fukushima 1 and 2 that have gotten into trouble. And they were licensed, you know, as was Vermont Yankee and other plants, to less demanding standards than the current ones. Now, they've been upgraded to some degree since then, but there's generally resistance on the part of the companies to upgrade because it's expensive. And my suspicion is that these, since it was the oldest plants that got into trouble in Japan, that they were not, in fact, upgraded adequately. And I think the record on that is going to be very interesting in the postmortems. What the state of affairs is at Vermont Yankee, I just don't know.
Wasn't the 1 and 2 at Fukushima Daiichi scheduled to be decommissioned in a few months?
I had heard that that was that Unit 1 was reaching the 40-year mark, and that would be the end of it, but it would be closed down. But I'm not sure.
So Viktor Galinsky, again, a former commissioner with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we're talking about the current situation in Japan as much as we know of it. Interesting, and somewhat, I think, rather sadly, most of the when I'm on the air talking about trying to find out what's happening with this ongoing disaster in Japan, a lot of the listener messages that come on the screen are from people saying, "Will the radiation reach us?"
No, we're thousands and thousands of miles.
I know, but it doesn't sort of deal with the reality of what's happening in Japan.
Right. No, it's extremely grave. Now, I had heard that they think they can get power in there pretty soon, and if they do that, that would certainly be a big plus. What is unclear is whether the equipment that they need to operate is operable, and so that they can get various pumps and valves going and so on. But for that, you have to know the details, and we're just too far away from that.
But one of the things that seemed to come out of this, in terms of, and as you know from being with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, there are these red team kind of exercises to test security at our nuclear plants, and there have been various terrorist scenarios suggesting that if a terrorist were to fire a rocket-propelled grenade at the wall of one of these swimming pools to drain the water, you would have an accident or a disaster comparable to what's happening in Japan today. But this disaster in Japan seems to indicate to me that these plants are actually more vulnerable to nuclear terrorism if you can turn off the backup system as the earthquake and tsunami did in Japan.
Well, I think it may be a bit more difficult than you say, but the basic point is that you have a whole bunch of safety backup systems. They were designed and assumed to be independent, so the likelihood of all of them failing at the same time was very, very small, so it was thought. But if you have an event that couples them all, like a tsunami hitting them all and knocking over their fuel tanks, then those assumptions go out the window, and that's what happened here. I mean, people assumed that all these systems couldn't fail together. And the problem is a more general one. You may have three diesel generators that are in separate rooms and separately supplied and independently operated. On the other hand, so if the chance of one of them failing is 1 in 100, then you multiply 1 in 100 times 1 in 100 times 1 in 100, and the chance of all three of them failing at the same time is 1 in 1,000,000. But if the same maintenance guy, comes around and puts the wrong oil into each one of them, then, again, that assumption goes out the window. So you have to be very careful to examine these assumptions that have led to these very low probabilities of accidents. They're all based on these safety systems being independent, and often there are things that couple them, and it's really quite a subtle business.
Well, my understanding, Viktor Galinsky, is that Admiral Rickover, who to some extent pioneered the nuclear power industry in as much as the propulsion reactor for the submarines that he developed was scaled up to be the first nuclear plants, he apparently always felt that Murphy's Law being as it is and the requirement for discipline with nuclear power being so great that only the military should be running nuclear power. Is that something that...
No, I don't remember that he said the military. Actually, I knew Admiral Rickover, and he seemed to take a fatherly interest in me because I think we both came from Poland at the age of 6 or something. But at different times. But he certainly put safety first. There was no question about that. And incidentally, at one point, after he retired, he wanted to be sort of an informal chief inspector for the NRC, which I supported. And the rest of the commissioners were absolutely horrified and rejected the idea.
Given what's involved in controlling nuclear fission, do you think that mankind is up to the task?
Well, I'll tell you, it takes a tremendous sustained effort and discipline to run these plants. We've gotten pretty good at it, but when you talk about expanding it, really have to ask whether, with all these complications, and there's a whole range of other things that concern me anyway, the fact that technology spreads around the world, you're basically spreading the capability to make weapons or bringing people a lot closer to that capability. And, you know, it's, I don't know, I'm rethinking things myself, let me put it that way.
Well, just in closing then, Viktor Galinsky, one of the guests I had on yesterday said that, made the analogy that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, of which you, on which you served, was similar to the Minerals Management Division of Interior that had oversight over the BP rig in the Gulf, for example. And that was the analogy, is that the oil companies apparently had it either funded or had a
Watching those guys, I think the NRC isn't as bad as that.
Does it get its funding from the nuclear industry, or is it independently funded by the taxpayer?
Well, I think it's funded mainly by fees from the industry.
It is funded by
me. But there is a point to what you're saying. I think the agency has been overly accommodating to the industry. And in fact, it was, you know, a little over 10 years ago, it was basically broken by Senator Domenici, Pete Domenici. And this isn't just my observation. He brags about it in his book, how he did this and forced them, you know, to come to heel, and relishes it. It's a, he wrote a book on nuclear power, and you'll find it in there. And the agency kind of turned around. The chairman at that time, Shirley Jackson, fired the top experienced regulators that the industry didn't like. And after that, they were sort of a much more industry-friendly agency.
Well, we'll wait and see whether this event in Japan changes that. I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles.
Take care.
Dr. Viktor Galinsky. Again, Dr. Galinsky is an independent consultant on energy issues. He has been deeply involved in nuclear power, nuclear proliferation, and nuclear fuel cycles and waste issues. He served two terms as commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where he played an important role in tightening U.S. nuclear export standards. And most recently, he has been a consultant to the state of Nevada in relation to the proposed Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Repository. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how Libya is turning into a victory for Gaddafi, and then what do we do once that happens? Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm joined by Ambassador David Mack, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs from 1990 to 1993, and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates from 1986 to 1989. His diplomatic assignments included Iraq, Jordan, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Tunisia, and Libya. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador David Mack.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
Clearly, the freedom fighters, I suppose, as opposed to rebels in Libya, have suffered major reverses. It was predicted by the director of national intelligence about a week ago, but they look like they're getting routed, and now the road is open for Gaddafi's forces to the last rebel-held city of Benghazi. You actually served for 3 years as a U.S. diplomat in Libya and in Benghazi, right?
In both Tripoli, at the time Gaddafi came to power, and then 2 years in Benghazi, yes.
And there are a million people in that city.
Well, it was a much smaller city then, but and Cyrenaica, like most of Libya, is rather lightly populated. It's not a large population.
But it is an endangered population, surely, if there's going to be a retribution. And I imagine that in turn will create a refugee crisis, which I imagine...
It is a critical part of Libya because a very large proportion of the oil-producing reservoirs are in Libya and are in eastern Libya, in Cyrenaica, as they call it. And... the population there is obviously in danger of retribution. It's always been a rebellious population that didn't accept the domination of Gaddafi very well. The tribes in eastern Libya had been favored under the monarchy, and so there was a considerable amount of payback when Gaddafi took charge.
So when the French president, as he is now, urging the United Nations to get off the dime with this no-fly zone that they appear to be dithering over, and he's saying to the UN that if there's a military victory for Gaddafi, then the UN in itself will share the blame and the embarrassment.
Well, talk is pretty cheap coming from the French. They're the ones who sold the Libyans a lot of high-performance aircraft when we were not willing to do so. And, of course, the Soviet Union was selling them ground equipment, tanks, and so on. But the French have profited a lot from their relationship with Gaddafi's Libya. And so if there's to be a no-fly zone, the French ought to take a lead in that. And we'll see whether they... whether they produce as much as they say they will. Let's not forget it was the French and the British who talked us into establishing a no-fly zone over Iraq, which we conducted for 12 years, and the French backed out of that within months after it started.
Well, the Arab League, nevertheless, has called for a no-fly zone, and that one would think that would give some of the UN members some cover.
Absolutely, Ian, and you're getting to a very important point. And Secretary Clinton, in her remarks at the press conference in Cairo today, referred to that, because we've been finding resistance in the Security Council from three key nations, Russia, China, and Turkey. I believe that their ultimate position on taking effective action through the UN Security Council will be greatly improved by the fact that the Arab League took this position.
But Ambassador David Mack, will it be too late? Will Gaddafi have already taken back the entire country by then?
Well, Ian, with due respect, I think you're focusing too much, as most of the media have, on the question of a no-fly zone. At best, a no-fly zone can only be a small part of the overall international response to Gaddafi and his loyalist forces. No-fly zones, as we found in Iraq and in the former Yugoslavia, don't really deliver in protecting the population. And we know that most of the killing of Libyans that's being carried out by the Gaddafi loyalist forces is being done by tanks and artillery. Very little by aircraft. And so a no-fly zone was never going to be the solution to the problem. It can have a marginal significance in the overall operation. But what's most important is to get effective trainers on the ground to train up the Libyan freedom fighters, because I give them full credit for their courage and enthusiasm, but in military terms, they basically are nothing more than an armed mob. And you don't turn an armed mob into an effective fighting force just by giving them more weapons. They've got plenty of weapons that they got from the Libyan arsenals in Adjudabia and Benghazi. Their problem is they are almost totally lacking in organization and discipline. Now, as it happens, there is a very effective military force right next door, a very large military force. They are Arabic-speaking. They have a shared interest with us in making sure that Gaddafi is not able to resume his overall supremacy over eastern Libya, and that's the Egyptians. The Egyptian armed forces have a very large air force. They have very effective anti-tank units, and they would be able to take a lead role in an international effort to prevent Gaddafi from reasserting his total control over the area.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador David Mack, but of course, Colonel Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, in a press conference today said everything will be over in 48 hours. So I'm not going to take his word as gospel, but that would indicate bravado aside, that the momentum is with Gaddafi, and there is no movement on the part of, from my understanding, of organizing anything in terms of a force to counter him. And the Egyptians' military probably has its hands full at the moment, but is anybody asking them? I mean, as a former diplomat, what are the steps that need to be taken? And it seems to me that we're running out of time here if anybody's serious about doing something.
Well, it's one thing. It'll be one thing for the Libyan army to drive down the road all the way to the Egyptian border, which they may possibly do. It's entirely another thing for them to resume the kind of control over the cities in eastern and the population of eastern Libya that they had before these events started. I think we're in for a long period in which there's going to be serious opposition to the Gaddafi regime in eastern Libya. And it's a period in which there's going to be a lot of urban warfare, there's going to be guerrilla warfare, and it's a period in which we will need to have Arab participation in these international efforts. Let me just quote from what Secretary Clinton said in her press conference in Cairo. She said that they're making progress toward a resolution that would include a range of actions that the international community could take. And she referred specifically to Arab leadership and participation in the international efforts. And she also said, we're looking for a broad range of actions, not just a no-fly zone, but other actions as well. Now, I was in a meeting with Senator Kerry, the chairman of the Senate Armed Forces, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today. And Senator Kerry, along with Senator McCain on the Republican side of the aisle, are going to be meeting with Pentagon officials tomorrow to discuss the practicalities of military action. All of this focus on the no-fly zone makes it sound like it's just a video game. It's not. A no-fly zone is military intervention. It is a form of warfare. It involves the killing of civilians on the ground who happen to be in the proximity of air defense locations and radars that have to be taken out before you can have an effective no-fly zone. And it involves very seriously the prospect that the pilots of the aircraft might have to parachute over territory if they're hit by surface-to-air missile fire. And so it's a very, very serious action. And we want to have Arab governments involved, taking a lead, and that basically in this case means the Egyptian government.
Well, it does seem that at least given the endorsement of a no-fly zone, albeit not necessarily any kind of panacea from the Arab League, that would indicate that there's a consensus against Gaddafi. But Ambassador David Mack, if he is able to take a city of a million people, and surely he'll take some retribution, won't he? I mean, he's already murdered thousands of his people in a prison back in 1996. He's capable of unbridled inhumanity.
Well, I think he's going to find it much harder to reassert control than to maintain control. And this genie is out of the bottle. And I think you're focusing way too much. I don't mean you personally, Ian Masters. I mean the media and all of the speculation about what might be done, focusing way too much on one tool, a no-fly zone, when there's a broad range of tools that can be used, ranging from covert action to actual military trainers on the ground, which in my view should not be American. They should not even be European. They should be Arab. As economic actions, as well as inducements to key people in Gaddafi's support base to turn against him. There's a whole range of actions that have to be considered and coordinated.
So Ambassador David Mack, these reversals then, which have driven driven the rebellion way back just to Benghazi, and it was in 30 miles or so of Tripoli, Gaddafi's stronghold. So there was an enormous amount of the country that was actually in rebel hands up until a few days ago. Now he's basically taken it all back. So not focusing on the no-fly zone, but on figuring out what the next step may be. I mean, it's going to be a lot more difficult, surely, having lost all that territory, to take it back.
Well, if I may say so, the Libyan opposition and a lot of the international media thought this was going to be a cakewalk. They thought that Gaddafi was such a nutcase and so unpopular that he could be shoved aside immediately. And they were in for a rude shock. But that doesn't mean that Gaddafi has the effective capability of maintaining and sustaining long-term control over this country. He doesn't. And that there will be some serious humanitarian problems is without doubt. But that Gaddafi's long-term time in power is limited, I believe that's the case.
And, of course, four New York Times reporters were apparently captured in Ajibaya, and their fate is unknown. It's certainly a grim situation, and I suppose do you think, though, Ambassador David Mack, that this is in any way likely to become a political issue? That who lost Libya? Here we have Gaddafi thumbing his nose at the whole world. Do you think there'll be any kind of backlash if the inevitable happens and Gaddafi triumphs?
Well, you know, I hope this will not. That U.S. domestic politics will not become the principal issue or even a major issue here. I have to say that this is about Libya. It's about democracy in the Arab world. It is not about U.S. politics. And we know what works in Libya and we know what doesn't work. We tried the latter in the 1980s. We used unilateral action. President Reagan called Gaddafi the mad dog of the Middle East. I'm sure that was viscerally satisfying, but it was ultimately not very helpful. We bombed Libya. We had covert action programs to support Libyan opposition, which proved to be totally feckless. And we had unilateral sanctions. And by the end of the 1980s, we had not changed Libya's behavior with regard to terrorism or weapons of mass destruction acquisition, one whit. All we'd done was cause lots of problems for the Libyan people and a great increase in anti-Americanism among the younger Libyans. And we had a lot of dead Americans at the end of that decade. In the 1990s, we took a different approach. We got UN Security Council resolutions that were well-tailored and ultimately very effective. We mobilized virtually universal implementation of those sanctions. And by the end of the 1990s, we were well on the way to getting Libya out of the business of international terrorism, compensating the victims of that terrorism, and getting Libya out of weapons of mass destruction and reaping a great bonanza in our knowledge of how these terrible weapons were being spread around the world. So we know what works, we know what doesn't work. I think we're doing the right thing, getting as strong and as global an approach to this as possible. It would be entirely wrong to make this an issue of Gaddafi versus Obama. That's exactly what Gaddafi, and I might say Osama bin Laden, would like it to be.
Well, just in closing then, Ambassador David Mack, is this, given that the International Criminal Court have already put Gaddafi on notice, but of course there is no enforcement mechanism to arrest him and to stop what he's doing, do you feel in any way that Gaddafi is emboldening other dictators? I'm not sure that this is the first time this line has been crossed, but the very notion of a dictator using sophisticated military weaponry against his own civilians and citizens is an appalling affront, I think, to the world. And
well, I think, Ian, you said it. You already referred to it. It's been done over and over again by dictators. I think the important thing here is we're not going to change Gaddafi's attitude. I don't think I think that martyrdom is attractive to him. I think he will fight down to the last bullet. But the whole objective has to be to change the attitude of the people on whom he depends for continuing his power and his stranglehold over Libya. Those people can be induced to turn against him, to have an internal coup or an assassination, and that should be our objective, to get them to make sure that they don't go down with him.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Ambassador David Mack.
You're welcome, Ian.
I've just been speaking with Ambassador David Mack, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs from 1990 to 1993, and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates from 1986 to 1989. His diplomatic assignments included Iraq, Jordan, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Tunisia, and Libya. We're now going to take a brief station break, and we'll come back talking about what is behind the incredibly high price of oil, what's really behind the incredibly high price of oil. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently is the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures options and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Greenberger.
Happy to be here. Good to talk to you, Ian.
And what really does explain the cost of the price of oil? It's actually went down a little bit yesterday, but it's been for the last few days at Brent crude at $115 a barrel and U.S. crude at $105. And my understanding is that there are $40 billion in bets on the commodities market that oil will go up. And doesn't that, if you bet that oil is going to go up, doesn't that help it go up?
It certainly does, and it's quite ironic because in the summer of 2008, we had a similar experience where oil was shooting up to the point where it reached a world record high in mid-July of $147 for a barrel of the American benchmark crude oil product. And many of us, since May 2008, had been arguing that this was not a supply-demand problem, but it was a problem of excessive speculation in these markets where big banks, those banks, by the way, that we all bailed out in September of 2008, were essentially offering casino-like bets on the upward direction of a basket of 25 commodities to wealthy investors and wealthy institutions. The analysts of those banks were saying oil's nearing 150, it will probably go to 200. Why don't you buy something with a technical name called a commodity index swap, which is nothing more than going to a betting window and say, here's my money, I want to bet that the price of commodities will go upward. The banks, just like a bookie, had to lay off the risk. They essentially were going to have to pay for a dollar for every dollar, for example, oil went up. So they turn around and go into the real oil markets and buy oil futures that have a direct impact on the spot price of oil. And to the extent the bets increase in their shop, they've got to go shop more and more for contracts that entitle them to the delivery of oil. By the end of that summer, both the House and the Senate were fully convinced that supply-demand had nothing to do with it. In both houses, the House by a 2-to-1 majority and the Senate in another situation where they couldn't get cloture or 60 votes, but they got 53 votes, both voted to limit this speculative activity because of its adverse impact on the markets. There's been a debate
now for the succeeding roughly 3 years. We thought the issue was put to rest when the Dodd-Frank Financial Regulatory Reform Bill was passed, which had a very serious mandate in it that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission should limit this betting because it costs a speculative premium to the American consumer. But on January 26th, it became clear that there were almost certainly not enough votes in the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to implement what Congress required. And since that day, through the end of last week, oil has risen almost 25% because the speculators know there's no cop on the beat. Of course, what they're saying is it's the unsettling circumstances in Libya, the possibility that Saudi Arabia will collapse. But those Libya has a very small percentage of the world oil market. Even with Libya out of commission, and they're not out of commission, there's more than enough supply to meet demand. The Saudi government appears that it has trouble, but appears also very stable. And what is really being used is the cover of using the excuse of unsettling circumstances in the Middle East is forming a cover of darkness for speculators to race into the market. And the market is now awash with excessive speculation. Only recently, in the last, say, 10 days, has this received renewed attention. CBS Evening News did a story about it last week, and Ed Schultz on MSNBC ran four different stories on it. And frankly, the fact that people's attention is being called to the speculation, I think, explains why the price has sort of dropped recently.
And Michael Greenberger, again, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the spike in back in 2008 of up to $147 a barrel, 60 Minutes did an investigation into that, and they found that that was not due to ExxonMobil hoarding oil, but to they named J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs as the biggest holders of oil contracts in the world.
Yes, that's what they discovered was that Morgan Stanley, who is a big casino operator in this field, actually was so convinced that they now had established a practice to drive the price of oil up. They bought enough oil to become the largest heating oil dealer in New England. And you may recall in 2009, there was a very disappointed Citibank executive who was being denied a $100 million bonus because of federal limits imposed on the bailout of Citi. And how did he make his money? He made his money loading tankers full of oil and sending them around the world and causing a false supply-demand indicator and driving the price of oil up. And he believed he was entitled to a $100 million bonus. What's discouraging is every time this happens, we have to re-educate Congress and re-educate the American public that there's not a supply-demand problem. There is a big bank speculation problem here. And by the way, it's not just oil, it's all commodities. Food prices are going through the roof, and it's all derives from the same thing. You can place bets with big banks. You don't own anything except the bet that the price of a basket of 25 commodities will go up. The banks have to turn around in the real commodity markets and buy futures contracts that drive the price of everything from red wheat to copper, to crude oil, through the roof. You hear that core inflation is not advancing. What they mean by core inflation is everything except food and oil, or food and energy. Well, that's where we're getting hit. And a lot of very well-respected economists worldwide, and interestingly enough, the European Union, which has been much more sensitive to this, are making it clear that if we are to have a recovery from the collapse in 2008, which was caused by these very same banks, we cannot have a commodity bubble in food and energy.
So, Michael Greenberger, this means that a handful of people are getting incredibly rich, speculating, and they're doing things that should be criminal, like filling tankers up and sending them off to cruise around in circles, just so that the price will all go up. Our audience, people go to the pump all the time. We're in a recession. We're trying to recover from a recession. This is hitting average mom and pop America in a place where it hurts, and they're already hurting. I mean, I just don't understand why our political leaders aren't crying foul.
Well, it's my hope. What I saw in the summer of 2008 was when gasoline went over $4 a gallon. The American people really got up in arms about it, and that had an effect of blunting all the lobbying. And by the way, the big oil companies profit from this, but they aren't driving this cost. It's really the very banks that we bailed out in the fall of 2008, winter of 2009. But the problem here is that they even have now passed a law that should control this. But the Congress has changed. The Republican majority in the House wants to undo these laws. The regulators who are required to implement it are standing on their heads to avoid doing their job. And most disappointingly, President Obama, when he was running for president in June of 2008, called out the speculators and called for tough regulation, but in his speech last week, there wasn't a word about this excessive speculation. The point I would make here is that to blunt this, you don't even have to bring a criminal prosecution. You don't have to prove that there's an intent to drive the price up. There is supposed to be in place things called speculative position limits that are imposed that limit the ability of these speculators to get their hands on all the contracts they'd like to buy to cover the bets they're making to wealthy investors. And what simply is happening right now is the Obama administration is not talking about this. Congress is not talking about it. And the regulators are looking the other way. And only if the American people speak to their representatives, their senators, their members of Congress, contact the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. They're having a rulemaking session on this now that closes on March 28th, and tell them that they absolutely must limit the participation of speculators in the market where they are needlessly driving the price of these commodities up.
And Michael Greenberger, again, formerly director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Logically, you would think that the only people who would be trading in commodities would be the end users, the oil refineries or the Pillsbury for the wheat and Archer Daniel Midland, people who actually do something with the product and turn it into something else, into another product. Since they're dealing with raw materials. That seems to be the logic. Wasn't that the original intention of a commodities market?
It's exactly. It's not only the intention, it's the purpose of the commodities market to allow the producer of energy products, the producers of food products, to hedge, to ensure they make a reasonable return, and for the consumers of food and energy in the business world to hedge. So you have a tension in these markets between the producers and the consumers that makes the price adhere to market fundamentals. And you need some speculation in order to create liquidity for the commercial users of these products. The key word is excessive speculation. When you have too many speculators, and the farmers in the late 20s and 1930s, early 1930s, during the Depression, spotted this completely, that their prices were being driven not by supply-demand, but by speculators in the market. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of the first pieces of legislation he sent to Congress was to put speculation limits on this gambling so that the producers and consumers had a market where they could hedge their risk and avoid having excessive costs. Those position limits got eaten away by non-transparent staff exemptions granted to big banks So they were completely dormant by the time we got to the summer of 2008, and there was a commodity bubble, not only in oil, but in food and other energy products. We thought we had it fixed. We got a law passed in July of 2010, but, you know, it now appears that it's just so many words on paper. The drafters of that law don't seem to be encouraging administrative compliance. The president isn't mentioning it, even though when he campaigned, he promised he would drive speculators from these markets. So unless the American public wakes up, they're not only going to be paying money they can't afford to go into the pockets of big bank traders, but it has the likelihood of breaking the back of the economic recovery and sending us into another recession. And in another recession, there's not going to be any bullets left. There will be no TARP money. TARP is politically infeasible to get through again. No stimulus package, no quantitative easing. And in the absence of creating a financial safety net, we could be facing the very deluge that we thought we escaped in the fall of 2008, and that is a depression.
So just in wrapping this up, Michael Greenberger, the same people who brought our economy to a near death that we bailed out back in 2008 are now screwing us again, and they could screw us to the point where we'll go, that we won't recover from the recession and we'll go back into a double dip.
That is absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And the credit crisis in 2008 was caused by gambling on subprime mortgages. And right. Now it's gambling on the direction of commodity prices.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, Michael Greenberger.
Again, Happy to do it, Ian. Good to talk to you.
Again, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Future Trading Commission. This has been a Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You may leave comments, and I would love to know what you think. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.